Chapter 2 Belisarius watched Rana Sangha and his men ride away. Not until the Rajputs had vanished did he turn to Dadaji Holkar. "I don't think he's typical of Rajputs," he said. It was more of a question than a statement. The Maratha slave disagreed, instantly and without hesitation. With any other master, he would not have done so. By ancient Indian custom, though only the Malwa had ever written it into law, the slave was expected to cherish as well as obey his master. That Dadaji Holkar did so, in actual fact, was due as much as anything to the fact that his outlandish foreign master interpreted obedience as devotion to his purpose rather than his person.
"You misunderstand him, master.
Rana Sangha is quite famous. Most Indians, and all Maratha, consider him the truest of Rajputs. He is perhaps the greatest Rajput warrior today living, and certainly the finest Rajput general. His exploits are legend. He is a king also, of course. But," the Maratha smiled, "that means little by itself. There are so many Rajput kings, most of whom ruled their little hilltop as if it were all the universe. But Sangha is of the Chauhan dynasty, which is perhaps their greatest line of royalty. And the Chauhan are known for their thought as well as their archery and swordsmanship." But Belisarius cocked his eyebrow. "And so?" Dadaji Holkar shrugged. "And so, Rana Sangha is the truest of Rajputs and takes his deepest pride in that fact. But because he does so and thinks like a Chauhan thinks, he also ponders on what being a Rajput means. He knows, you see, he has even been heard to make the occasional jest about it, that the Rajput lineage is really not so much grander than that of we disreputable Maratha hillmen. And he also knows that the lineage is true nonetheless. And so he thinks about lineage, and how it comes to be, and how truth emerges out of illusion. And he wonders, I think, where the difference between truth and illusion lies, and what that means for his dharma." The slave stroked the horse's neck. "Those are dangerous thoughts, master. Outside of their sorcerous weapons and their vast armies, the Malwa have no resource so valuable to them as the skill of Rana Sangha on the battlefield. But I believe they fear that resource as much as they treasure it."
"Do they have reason to fear him?" asked Belisarius.
Dadaji Holkar squinted into the distance where the Rajputs had disappeared.
"Hard to know, master.
Raghunath Rao once said the day would come when Rana Sangha would choose between Rajputana's honor and Rajputana's duty. And that when that day came, the truest of Rajputs would understand that only honor gives duty meaning."
The Roman general scratched his chin.
"I was not aware the two men knew each other."
"Oh, yes. They fought once in single combat. They were both young at the time, but already famous warriors. It is a well-known episode."
Belisarius started slightly.
"I'm amazed either of them survived."
The slave smiled.
"So were they, and everyone, but survive they did.
Badly wounded, of course, both of them. Early in the fray, with his bow, Sangha slew the Maratha chieftain's horse and then wounded Rao in the arm. But he became overconfident and closed too soon. Rao gutted the Rajput's mount and then pressed him with sword and iron-clawed gauntlet. Here the combat was even, and they fought until both were bloody and disarmed. Then they fought by hand. No man in India beside Rana Sangha could have held his own against Raghunath Rao in unarmed combat. He was not as skilled, of course, but he was much larger and stronger. By the end of the day, both men were too weak and exhausted to lift an arm or even stand. So they laid down side by side and continued their combat with words."
Belisarius chuckled. "And who won?"
Holkar shrugged. "Who's to say? At sundown, they decided honor had been satisfied. So they called upon their followers to carry them away and tend their wounds, and the armies themselves never clashed. All the Rajputs and Marathas present felt the duel had been so glorious that any further combat would only sully the memory. As the years passed, both Rao and Sangha became famous commanders, although they never met on the field of battle again, neither as warriors nor as generals. But from that day forward, Raghunath Rao has always stated that there exists no greater archer in the world than Rana Sangha, and not more than four or five who are his equal with a sword. For his part, Sana makes the equal claim for Rao's clawed gauntlet and his fists, and swears he would rather fight a tiger with his own teeth than face Rao again in the field of philosophy. Melisarius's chuckle became an outright laugh. What a marvelous tale! How much truth is there in it, do you think? Holker's face was solemn. It is all true, Master, every word. I was at that battle and helped bind Rao's wounds myself. The Roman general stared down at his slave. Dadaji Holker was a small man, middle-aged, gray-haired, and slightly built. In his appearance as well as his demeanor, he seemed every inch the highly literate scribe that he had been before the Malwa enslaved him. Belisarius reminded himself that, for all his intellect, Dadaji Holker was from Maharashtra. Maharashtra, the great country. A land of volcanic stone, harsh and unforgiving. The land of the Marathas, who, if they were not India's most noble people, were certainly its most truculent. I do not doubt you, Dadaji, he said softly. The Roman general's large and powerful hand for just an instant caressed the slender shoulder of his Maratha slave, and the slave knew in that moment that his master was returning his own cherishment. Holker left abruptly then, leading Belisarius's horse to its feeding trough. He squeezed his eyes, shutting back the tears. He shared his master's tent and had listened night after night while his master spoke softly to the divine presence in his mind. He knew from those muttered words that Belisarius had met Rao himself. Had met Rao not in this world, but in the world of a vision. In that world of vision, all of India had fallen under the Malwa talons, and Rome had eventually followed. In that world, Rao had failed to save Maharashtra and had become, through the strange workings of fate, the Maratha slave of the greatest of Roman generals. Gently, Dadaji Holker stripped the horse of her saddle and began wiping the mare down. He was fond of horses, and by her nuzzle knew the fondness was reciprocated. He knew also that Belisarius's invariable kindness to him was partly the transference of his feelings for Rao onto another of his countrymen. Belisarius had said to him once that in a lifetime where he had met many fine men, he had never known a finer than Raghunath Rao. But Dadaji Holker had come to know his new master well in the months since he had been purchased in Barakucha to train a newly arrived foreigner in India's tongues and scripts. And so he knew that he was himself a man to Belisarius, not simply a surrogate for another, and that the heart of the Roman's love for him belonged to he himself. He, and his loyalty, and his service, and the memory of his broken people and his shattered family. The slave Dadaji Holker began feeding his master's horse. There were none to see now, so he let the tears flow freely. Then, after a moment, raised his blurry vision and gazed at the distant, splintering brick walls of rebel Ranipur. Ranipur will fall soon. The Malwa beasts will savage its people, even worse than they savaged my own. He lowered his gaze, wiped the tears from his face, watched the horse feed. He enjoyed watching the mare's quiet pleasure as she ate. It reminded him a bit of the joy he had taken watching his wife and children eat the food he had always placed on their table, until the Malwa came and devoured his family whole. Enjoy your triumph, Malwa cobras. It will not last. You have let the mongoose himself into your nest. The horse was done feeding. Holker led her into the thatched stalls which the Roman soldiers had erected for their horses. The stalls were very large and completely shielded from outside view. An outside view which might have wondered, perhaps, why such a small body of men would need such a large number of horses. And such fine horses. Indeed, they were very fine. Holker was fond of the mare, but he knew she was the poorest of the mounts which rested in the stalls. The Romans never rode the fine ones, the superb riding steeds which Holker himself had purchased, one by one, from the various merchants scattered about the siege of Ranipur. Horses which were always purchased late in the day and led into their stalls in the dark of night. His master had never explained the reasons for those purchases, nor had Holker inquired. Nor had Belisarius explained the reason for purchases which were still more odd. Not 2 days ago, at his master's command, Holker had purchased 3 elephants. 3 small, well-tamed, docile creatures which were kept in a huge but simple tent
located in a small clearing in the forest, many miles from the siege, and many miles from the official camp of the Romans and Ethiopians. Holker had asked no questions. He had not asked why the tent should be so far away, and so different in appearance from the grandiose pavilion which the Ethiopian Prince Aeon had erected for himself and his concubines. Nor why the elephants themselves should be so different in their appearance from the two huge and unruly war elephants which the Ethiopians maintained as their public mounts. Nor why the elephants were only fed at night, and only by the African slave named Usanas, whose invisibility in the darkness was partly due to the color of his skin, but mostly to his incredible skill as a hunter and a woodsman. No, Holker had simply obeyed his master's commands and not asked for any explanation of them. The Maratha didn't think that his master could have explained, even had he asked. Not clearly, at least. Not precisely. The mind of Belisarius didn't work that way. His thoughts never moved in simple straight lines, but always at an angle. Where other men thought of the next step, Belisarius thought of the next fork in the road. And where other men coming upon that fork would see a choice between right and left, Belisarius was as likely to burrow a hole or take to the trees. He closed the thatched door to the stalls. There was no lock, nor need of one. The Kushans would make short work of any thief or intruder. As he made his slow way back to his tent, Holker smiled. Darkness had now fallen, but he could sense the keen scrutiny of the Kushan guards. Almost as keen as their curiosity, he thought, chuckling. But they kept their curiosity to themselves. When Kunga's commands, his men obey. The Kushans also ask no questions. Holker glanced over to the huge pavilion which belonged to Prince Aeon. About nothing, Holker suspected, were the Kushan guards more curious than that tent. Although he wasn't certain, he thought that the Kushan commander already knew the secret within that tent. Knew it, and knew his duty, and had decided to ignore that duty for reasons which Holker could only surmise. The Kushan commander's face was impossible to read ever, but Holker thought he knew the man's soul. Dadaji Holker himself, for that matter, had been told nothing. Nor had he ever entered Prince Aeon's pavilion. But he was an acutely observant man, and he had come to know his new master well. Holker was certain that inside that tent rested the person of Shakuntala, the only survivor of the Satavahana dynasty, the former rulers of conquered Andhra. Like everyone in India, the tale had spread like wildfire. Holker knew that the famed Maratha chieftain Raghunath Rao had rescued Shakuntala from her Malwa captors months ago. But where all others thought she had escaped with Rao, Holker was certain that she had been hidden away by Belisarius and his Ethiopian allies, disguised as one of Prince Aeon's many concubines. Again, he smiled. It was exactly the sort of cunning maneuver that his master would relish. Faint and counterfeint, strike from an angle, never directly, confuse and misdirect. In some manner, Holker suspected, Belisarius had even been responsible for the replacement of Shakuntala's Kushan guards by priests and torturers. The same Kushan guards who now served as Belisarius' own escort had earlier been Shakuntala's guardians. Holker had seen enough of them over the past months to realize that not even Raghunath Rao would have been able to penetrate their security. He paused for a moment, considering the tent. A faint sneer came to his face. The Malwa would pay him a fortune for his knowledge. But Holker never even considered the possibility of treachery. He was devoted to Belisarius as much as he hated the Malwa. And besides, like Raghunath Rao, he was a Maratha himself. The Princess Shakuntala, the Empress now, was the rightful ruler of Maharashtra. She was his own legitimate monarch. And with a mental bow, Dadaji Holker acknowledged that suzerainty. He resumed his progress toward Belisarius's tent. A little smile came to his face. Like many intelligent, well-educated men, Dadaji Holker had a fine sense of historical irony. So he found his fierce loyalty to the memory of Andhra amusing in its own way. When the Satavahana dynasty had been at the peak of their power, the Marathas had been the most unruly of their subjects. Never since its incorporation into Andhra had Maharashtra risen in outright rebellion. But the Satavahanas had always been careful to rule the great country with a light hand. Now that all of Andhra was under the Malwa heel, the Marathas had become the most fervent partisans of the former dynasty, none more so than Dadaji Holkar. A sudden bright flash on the horizon drew his gaze. Holkar halted, stared. Moments later, the sound of the cannonade rolled over the encampment. He resumed his steps. Soon, yes, Ranipur will fall, and the cobra will sate itself again, as it has so many times. He drew near his master's tent. For a moment, he stopped, studying that simple structure. Not much to look at, truly. But then the mongoose never takes pride in its appearance. It simply studies the cobra and ponders the angles. Holkar began pulling back the tent flap. Another rolling cannonade caused him to pause, look back. For a moment, his scholar's face twisted into the visage of a gargoyle, so driven was he by hatred for all things Malwa. But there were no Malwa spies close enough to see that face. Such spies had learned quickly that the endless squabbles over women between the foreigners and their Kushan escorts seemed to erupt in sudden brawls, which, oddly, injured no one but bystanders watching the scene. In the first days after the foreigners set up their camp, two Malwa spies had been accidentally mauled in such melees. Thereafter, the spies had kept a discreet distance and reported as little as possible to their overseers, lest they be ordered to resume a close watch. The slave pulled back the flap and entered the tent. He saw his master squatting on a pallet, staring into nothingness, mouthing words too soft to hear. Hatred vanished, replaced first by devotion to his master's person, then by devotion to his master's purpose, and then by devotion itself. For the slave had closed the demon world of Malwa behind him and had entered the presence of divinity. He knelt in prayer, silent prayer, for he didn't wish to disturb his master's purpose, but fervent prayer for all that. Across the ancient, gigantic land of India, others also prayed that night. Millions of them. 200,000 prayed in Ranipur. They prayed first for deliverance from the Malwa, and then, knowing deliverance would not come, prayed they would not lose their souls as well as their bodies to the Asura. As Holkar prayed, his family prayed with him, though he knew it not. His wife, far away in a nobleman's mansion in the Malwa capital of Kaushambi, hunched on her own pallet in a corner of the great kitchen where she spent her days in endless drudgery, prayed for her husband's safety. His son, squeezed among dozens of other slave laborers on the packed earth floor of a shack in distant Bihar, prayed he would have the strength to make it through another day in the fields. His two daughters, clutching each other on a crib and a slave brothel in Pataliputra, prayed that their pimps would allow them to remain together another day. Of those millions who prayed that night, many, much like Holkar, prayed for the 10th Avatara who was promised. Prayed for Culkin to come and save them from the Malwa demon. Their prayers, like those of Holkar, were fervent. But Holkar's prayers, unlike those of others, were not simply fervent. They were also joyous. For he, almost alone in India, knew that his prayers had been answered, knew that he shared his own tent with the 10th Avatara, and knew that not more than 5 feet away, Culkin himself was pouring his great soul into the vessel of the world's deliverance, into the strange, crooked, cunning mongoose mind of his foreign master.